Welcome to Creative Piecemeal Podcast, a podcast for creatives. I'm your host, Tami Takeishi. Join me for compelling conversations with artists, actors, authors, musicians, and other creatives about the impact of the creative and fine arts in their lives and our ever-changing world. Thank you for listening. Welcome to another episode of Creative Piecemeal Podcast. We are celebrating music here in the month of March, and I'm so very excited to have composer and shakuhachi soloist Sean Head. Sean Head has an active career as a shakuhachi soloist, along with being a composer and educator. He studied at the prestigious Cleveland Institute of Music and became the youngest non-Japanese shakuhachi master at 23. Head emphasizes the possibilities and coherence between Eastern and Western ideas, mixing the aesthetics and sensibilities of Japanese music with a Western musical framework. In 2019, he received the distinct honor of becoming an OSS Tai Shogun for his work in traditional Japanese music. He has toured worldwide and collaborated with various artists, including members of the Houston Symphony, Susanna Campbell of Shoso Duo, and the Westheimer String Quartet. Head currently performs on 8 flutes specifically crafted for him by revered flute maker Yozan Hikichi. As a person with Japanese heritage myself, I'm especially excited and honored to have Sean Head on the show. And I must admit, your music and your interest in the Japanese culture has made me appreciate my own culture and background more and become more interested in learning more about, you know, my family and that side of my history. Because growing up in the US, it's not really something I learned as much as I wanted to. So I feel like I'm making up for lost time. Like every time I watch your videos or share them with my father or look at your posts and listen to your music, I feel like I'm reconnecting with that part of myself. And also it's been a really nice way to reconnect with my father. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, first off. And thank you so much for those kind words. I think that is probably the nicest compliment I've ever received, that this idea of not only just connecting with your heritage, but the fact that you get to connect with your father more and create relationships. I think that's the essence of shakuhachi and the essence of music in general, is to bring us together and make us closer. So thank you so much for that. That was really moving. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, thank you. Like I said, it's just been so nice to be able to connect with my dad that way. So, and then, you know, being able to suddenly talk about his life in Japan. So it makes me want to go visit Japan even more. And you recently settled there. So how is it? How's the weather?
Well, we just have a nice heat wave happening right now. And of course, we're recording this earlier than the actual post date. But it is, it was recently really, really cold. And so, and we live in a house that's over 100 years old. So insulation is not yet a thing in old Japanese homes. So the mornings are very cold and, you know, you really feel the seasons, as they say.
But I bet it's totally worth it for all that beautiful scenery.
Yes, we have a private Japanese garden in front of our house. And this house that we live in is actually our great-grandfather's who built it in an early Taisho.
Oh, that's fantastic. And what a wonderful way to keep it in the family and connect with the heritage there of your new family there.
Oh, yes. And it's so much fun. And they're really excited that we're putting all the work into. It's not easy and it's not cheap, but fixing the old home up and doing all the work is really rewarding at the end of the day.
Excellent. Well, thanks for telling us a little bit about your home. One of the first questions I always ask the musicians is, who or what inspired you to become a musician?
So actually, it's a very roundabout way of how it all, because it wasn't just necessarily one person, but I think that it would be the person who pushed me and inspired me to do it would be my sister. And my sister, she was the one who first got me an instrument when I was a kid. She got me my first guitar. And I remember I couldn't play it at all. I mean, and it was one of those like first act instruments, you know, they're crappy. And, you know, I was like 5. I mean, I wasn't going to be playing music seriously. I didn't have a teacher or anything like that. I just strummed on the thing as loud as I could. But she would keep pushing me later on in life to actually take formal lessons and learn how to play like actual rock songs. And she really inspired me to want to become like a really good rock musician. So my first song actually was the Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones. And like, I will be honest, once I was able to play that, I thought I was the coolest kid ever. Like, there was no equivalent to anybody at my age, or any age for that matter, because I could play the Blitzkrieg Bop. It is such a good song, and it's just three chords, and it's not even full chords. They're all
power. Gotta love those power chords, right?
Just parallel fifths everywhere.
So obviously, after guitar, you moved on to other instruments. How did you decide on shakuhachi and prior to that, you know, violin and things like that?
When I was in elementary school, it was a requirement to do an instrument or choir, and I definitely didn't want to do choir because I didn't like the choir teacher. And so I started up with the viola, and viola was an on and off thing. And I chose it because no one else chose it. And I was like, well, if no one else can show it, I want to be different. I want to be edgy. And so I chose the instrument, and then it would be something that I was on and off for years, where I would play it and stop and play it and stop and play it and stop. But I had a teacher who, his name is TJ Hall, and he still works at the high school too, at Franklin High School in Franklin, Wisconsin. And he was just my inspiration for wanting to get into classical music and also wanting to compose as well. He himself is a composer and a wonderful Irish fiddle player. So he also does, you know, world music. And I mean, he was just kind of like the embodiment of like, oh yeah, like this is the kind of person I want to be. A really great teacher, a really great performer, a really great composer, and just a really good guy. And from there, I met members of Milwaukee Symphony, and I was inspired to just compose my own music and go to college and do that. When I was in college, I had an injury in my lower back, just cartilage. Basically, I was playing way too much, and I was playing with really bad technique, especially on my lower back. And so I'd have my hips pushed forward, and it was putting all the pressure right up on my lower spine. And from there, I couldn't play anymore. I couldn't play without like absolute pain. So I had to stop doing the viola, and I decided that I wanted to go to a conservatory. I wanted to be more in the conservatory environment. I wasn't good enough as a violist to make it in that area anyway. So I thought, you know, I'll just do composition. That's more than enough for me. Well, ended up that wasn't true. I really started to feel lonely, and I wanted to, you know, I wanted to play music with other people, and I wanted to have that connection with the audience member and just connection with people in general, because the composer is usually locked in a room with four walls and a door that has no window on it. And you just sit at the piano and you just write, but you're always by yourself. And as a person who just loves to be around other people, loves to talk, I like going to like, you know, I love having small parties at my house. That just doesn't work for me, which is ironic because I pick an instrument that most of the music is all solo music. But I'm still able to go and be on stage and communicate with my audience members. So that finding that shakuhachi when I was traveling in Asia, that was the moment where I was like, you know, this could be my outlet in to make music.
You know, it seems almost like it was a destiny, you know, your journey, finding your way through the different avenues of music and what you wanted to do and finding your way to the shakuhachi, or maybe the shakuhachi found you.
I definitely think that it was the shakuhachi chose me, because I didn't want to be a professional shakuhachi player. That wasn't like my thought process. I was like, you know, I'm just going to use this as my kind of fun thing to do on the side, and it's going to all learning all this music's going to inspire me to write more. And it's actually been the complete flip. I almost like I play like 8 hours a day because I of all my students and a lot of the practicing, and I want to discover new techniques and I want to work with composers, but I barely have time to write music myself now. So it's such a crazy flip.
It sounds like it worked out really well though. And you know, you've done excellent for yourself in such a difficult and revered instrument, I would say.
Yeah, but you know, I could never have done this instrument without the training I had at conservatory. The ear training, the musical theory background, the learning how to practice properly, working with, you know, world-class chamber musicians and soloists, and learning how to be a soloist and stuff like that. Like, that would never have come to me. I would never been able to do anything that I do in shakuhachi without all of that background. So like my time studying shakuhachi looks short. I mean, I'm still studying now, you know, that's a constant thing, but until becoming like that shihan, becoming that master, that time frame may look very short for a lot of people. But what they don't see is that I've been studying music since I was like 10 years old and learning how to play, how to count rhythms, how to hear music, how to analyze, how to practice yourself, and how to work with others. All those things I've had over a decade of experience doing, and at the highest level with, doing it at the Cleveland Institute of Music. So all of those things combined helped me become a shakuhachi player. If I started with shakuhachi, I think I'd be a lot worse of a player, and I don't think I would be anywhere near as confident with the instrument, or as inventive with it.
That's understandable. As a person who's played multiple instruments myself, you know, once you have that foundation, once you have that music degree with high caliber training, it makes it so much easier to be able to pick up other instruments, for sure.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But you still have to have a passion for it. You know, like it, you can't just pick up an instrument and just assume it's going to go well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That is very true. I mean, there's a lot of driving force behind the shakuhachi for me. And it's like, I mean, of course we have bad days with each other and, you know, I want to throw it out the window, but it's, you know, there's always that love there that I can't ever put you aside, no matter what happens.
That's how I feel when I discovered the ukulele. I mean, I grew up classically trained on piano and violin and cello, and then the ukulele comes along and it's like, oh, well, this is a happy little instrument and I just adore it. Although your instrument is much harder to play. Sure.
It is not easy. But you know, it's also finding a really good instrument is also really hard to find. And violin players, that's also like the price problem for violin, but also finding a good violin at an affordable price is very, very difficult.
Incredibly so.
I mean, it's your husband also plays cello, and that's no different either. I mean, oh my God, I've seen cellos that are $500,000, and just like I just can't believe that price.
Yes. And then you talk about bows, and bows get into the hundreds of thousands as well. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, that's a couple of houses you got right there in your hand.
Yeah. I'm lucky that I just have to buy the shakuhachi. I don't need like a second piece that goes with it.
So speaking of instruments, are there any other instruments that you would love to play? Like if you had all the time in the world, would you love to play and learn?
Ooh, that's such a good question. And I think that I would love to learn how to play the biwa. So the biwa is a four-stringed lute-like instrument, and it has like these super high bridges on them where you can bend the note down up like a whole step and sometimes even up a minor third. And they use it for a lot of music called like heikyoku, which is like music from the Heian period. And it's so cool. It's just such, and like there's singing involved with it. I love everything about it. And it's such a cool instrument.
Is it in any way related to the air hoop?
No, there's no bow. It actually uses a really large plectrum.
And there's
multiple different types of biwa. And so there's like samatsu biwa. I hope I'm getting that right, the pronunciation. I messed this up. I did a video about introduction of biwa, and I messed up one of the types of it. But there's a specific type that has to do more with like the epics of samurai, and like tells their story. And so one of my favorite pieces is actually Natsuno Yoichi, who is really famous for apparently taking down an entire Mongolian ship with one arrow or something like that, some dramatic, you know, samurai tale. But he was a really famous archer. And there's a piece about him where you play the biwa and you sing the song, and it's like you're interplaying. Like sometimes like the biwa is like showing like the battle scene, like it's so like crazy and like flamboyant, and then it slows down and then it talks about like his life or what are the things he did or his successes and stuff. So it's really cool.
That is very interesting. So it's like Japanese historical programmatic music.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like that. It's kind of like a, I don't know, it's not like an art song, but it's almost like an opera for one person.
That is very neat. I'm going to have to go look that up now. I'd never heard of that.
It's something I definitely want to learn more about. It's hard. There's not a lot, like, it's hard to learn anything about Japanese instruments in general because there's just not that much. Like, there's a lot of surface level things, but when you go deeper, like, if you want to look up a translation for what that song is about, not that I've like looked intensely, but I don't know of one off the top of my head, and not one that I could find and be like, ah, so that's what all the words are. Because it's also in old, it's in classical Japanese. So most Japanese don't know classical Japanese, or like they don't remember, or they're not very good at it because they only do so much of it in high school. So it's not like a one that people go, oh yeah, you know, like I can speak Shakespearean.
It is so interesting how that how language evolves too.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting actually, because when you look at Japanese language in like the Edo period, it's completely different. Like it looks like a different language.
I noticed that you're also learning to write in Japanese and do various painting, which I think is just so beautiful. Are those things that you're learning, are they inspiring your music making and your teaching, or how does that relationship work for you?
You know, I'm learning a couple things actually. I'm learning shodo, which is Japanese calligraphy with brush, and I'm also learning shomyo, which is Japanese liturgical chanting, the Buddhist chanting. And the reason why is like I've studied shakuhachi with like some of the greatest players, and I've learned so much from them, and I'm starting to hit like a wall. Like there's only so much technique we can talk about, and there's only so much stuff where you go, yeah, you know, if you do it, you can do it like this. And I go, yeah, I know. And I can also do it like this. And they go, oh yeah, you can do it like that. Well, did you think about this? And I thought about that. And they said, did you think about this? And I go, I didn't think about that. But it's, you know, it's just kind of like that interplay of, you know, just experimenting. And I was thinking, you know what, maybe I need to learn some other breath-based arts to help with inspiring and improve my shakuhachi playing. So through shodo, I'm learning a new vocabulary of words that are not in shakuhachi, or at least that are not used as often. Like I don't hear people talk about zanshin in shakuhachi, where zanshin is like the remainder of the soul. It's the first character is leftover, and the second character is kokoro, which is heart. And so that's kind of like the energy that's left over at the end of it. And then you return that back to your center, to the tanden, which is the point right below your navel for focus of meditation. And I was like, you know what? That's a really good point. I'm going to start using that with my students, and I'm going to start thinking of that more often as I play.
I'm definitely going to have to look. You're giving me so many things to look up, Sean.
It's like this sort of conversation that I'm having with you, it's just conversations that I've had with other people, and they like, they'll tell me something and I go, wow, that's really cool. I'm going to look that up. And then I have such an obsessive personality where once I learn, I find something that's cool, I just like YouTube everything. I start like searching the internet and I go, oh, there's a journal article about this. I'm going to read that. And then at one point, I'm just like, you know what? I'm learning all this stuff about it. I get there's just like everything in the world. This person says one thing. This person says another thing. This person says another thing. And there's just so much conflicting information in the calligraphy world. I'm just going to go find a teacher and I'm going to go study with them. And so then I found somebody and I started working with them. And, you know, she's wonderful. And she's really, really helping me with almost like relearning the basics of shakuhachi through shodo. And those absolute basics, I realize are like, you know what? I didn't even realize that I was doing that. And not being aware of something is just as bad as not knowing something, in my opinion. So it's wonderful. Now, shomyo, that's a whole nother ball of like, if you want to talk about something that's old, it originally comes from India, made its way through China and then through Japan. But it came in Japan, I think, like in the 700s or the 600s, same time as when like Kukai brought Shingon Buddhism to Japan. And this, oh my God, the music is just so beautiful. They have two different types of scales for shomyo. And this minor scale that they use, or this minor sounding scale, fits exactly with shakuhachi music. Like the melodies are so similar. And the way that the voice moves is the same way the shakuhachi moves. And it's like a whole new world of like, oh my God, I can take all of these sounds from my, like from shomyo, and I can just put them in shakuhachi playing. And it's just so cool. It really, you can go so deep.
So it sounds like shomyo, you said, is a type of singing?
Yes, type of
meditation. That is very interesting. And then of course, like you said, everything synthesizes and creates deeper meaning for your work with shakuhachi.
Yeah, and you know, I think that that's like one of the problems with like and this, my teacher explained this perfectly, my shakuhachi teacher. He said that, you know, when you're in America, you don't have a lot of opportunities to experience breath-based arts at an extraordinarily high caliber. So when he was in Japan in the 80s and 90s, he said that he would just go to the no theater and he would sit in the audience and just watch them play and match up his breath with it. And I was like, that is such a good idea. And so then I went to a concert and I did the same thing. And I was like, I can find things that I like and what I don't like. And, you know, especially watching like calligraphy in person and hearing the person breathe, like that's something they cut out. They put like music over the calligraphy. I'm like, I'd rather hear the person breathe, but that's more like the nerdy side. Like people want to hear the music and all that stuff. But for me, I want to hear that person breathe because I want to match my breath with them and see how they're doing it to kind of go deeper. But almost all of the arts, and I would actually say all of the arts in Japan are breath-based. So no matter what I go to see, whether it's tea, whether it's kabuki, whether it's, you know, anything, aikido or sword trainings or whatever, that all has to do with the breath. It has to do with the tanden. It has to do with, you know, it's more about what you're doing. No. It's more about how you're doing it rather than what you're doing.
If you're feeling stressed, burnt out, or having compassion fatigue, there are resources available to you. Dr. Ani Kunimura runs the Self-Care Institute, and she currently has openings for the wildly popular Resilience Over Burnout, a self-care course. It is 31 continuing education credits, and you can enroll now until April 25th. Additionally, she offers other courses and resources on her website. Please visit selfcareinstitute.com for more information. I can see that. You know, at least from what I know, most Asian cultures, you know, there's so much intent, you know, focus on the intent of the action and the intent of the product being created, like, well, and, you know, having a really strong purpose of that.
It's interesting because I think that part of that statement is really right. And then there's another part of it that's wrong, which is that focus part, like the focus on it. My Shodo teacher says, why, like, stop thinking so much about it. Like, don't try to make the brush move with the brush, which means that everything has to be natural. And if you focus on it and you try to do it, it becomes unnatural. So, you know, she's super strict. You know, my first lesson with her, we did one line for an hour, just one line. And you're like, well, that's just ridiculous. How hard is it to draw a line? Very hard. And I'll tell you why. It's because when you don't do it properly, the ink is actually, it's not as dark. And so they call that fukai, like deep. And so when you do it poorly, the ink is actually lighter. It's so strange. And I can't tell you why it's that way, other than the fact that it's just like, I'll tell you what my teacher says. You are connecting with the universe and using the energy of the gods. All right, I'll take that. I mean, if I can write with the energy of the gods, sign me up. But when you do it right, and when you don't think about anything, and you just allow it to be, like, when does the line end? I don't know. When it ends. And you just have this feeling like, right there, that's where it ends. You know, it's almost reminds me of that story where this, I can't remember the monk's name, but this one monk asks another monk, what is Zen? And at that moment, he was like grounding flax or whatever. And he says, like, I think like three pounds of flax. And it's just like at that moment, it's what it is. Like, what are you drawing? I don't know. I'll know when I'm done. When are you going to be done? When it's done.
I feel like that relates so well to the creative art field, because when you're composing music or you're writing a poem, you know, or you're writing a song for a friend or what have you, or making a painting, you know, there's like, you get this feeling within yourself where you know when something is finished.
Yeah. But, you know, everybody's process is really different. I was always much more of a through composer, and I do a lot of things like that. Even like with shakuhachis, I don't try to, like, there's my planning process of, you know, I play through something and I go, that didn't work. I need to find something else and then try again. And then, that didn't work either. Then try again. Oh, maybe. And whatever. But, you know, it's like, I'm reminded of a story that one of my other composition teachers told me about John Corigliano, where like he would write out full diagrams and colors and colors and pictures and lines and everything of his piece, of what it would look like, before he even wrote the first note down. So he had like this full mapped out plan of this is how it's going to go. Then he writes the full piece and then it's done. Whereas like for somebody like somebody else, they would just sit down and they just go, all right, here's the beginning. Right. Okay, it's done. Not changing it. And then of course there's people that are in between. So it's, you know, all over the place with that. But I think that's why I like the shodo so much, is that there is no correcting. You can't go back and fix anything. Because if you do, you can see how the ink changes and you can see the stroke in the ink. Unlike where in Western, what is that, oil painting? On oil and canvas, you can, you know, do it again and again and again. And you have to, because like there's multiple layers of the ink. And then it takes like 3 months to dry for one of those paintings. Shodo is dried in 50 seconds. It captures that moment and just that moment alone. And I'm also then immediately reminded of one of the things that my teacher said about his shakuhachi recordings, is that he says, I don't go back and edit anything. I don't do multiple takes. I just perform it once for the CD. And then if there's mistakes in it, that's part of the piece. That's my energy in the piece. And I go, God, I wish I had that confidence.
Yeah, wow. You would not hear very many musicians at all do that.
Yeah, especially not today. But I mean, like there's a, back in the day when you would hear the great pianist, I think, was it Richter or Horowitz, like plays wrong notes. But the phrase is so immaculate. Like, why would you delete that? Why would you try to redo it? Did you hear the phrase? Did you hear how beautiful that music was? Keep it.
Mm-hmm. It's very similar, like in music therapy, when we're doing music, whether it's recreating music or composing music, it's not about the performance. It's not about the mistakes. It's about the act of music making and the healing and the journey that you're going on. And you're not thinking about you're going to edit this out later, because it's not about that. You know, it's about the journey of making the music and doing the music. So that reminds me a lot of what you were talking about, that story of the musician who just does the one take, because it's true. It's your energy and what's happening in that moment.
My good friend, who's a wonderful violinist and educator, he told me a story about this young kid who was back in like the 60s, who was this violin virtuosi, like one of the best who had ever lived, and it died very young too. And he was doing a recording of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, and in the piece he had one note that was off, just one note that was a little bit off, and the recording engineer said, I can fix that. And when he tried to fix it, the tape caught on fire and everything was destroyed. And then apparently died the next week or something like that. So it's like, also like, don't mess with it. Like, don't mess with things that, you know. And then actually, interestingly enough, I told that story to another Japanese musician friend of mine, Kyle Abbott, who I just helped do a CD with him. And he was telling me the same thing happened with a shamisen player that he loves. He plays shamisen. And he said they were going to listen to this recording that has never been, you know, it never digitized. It was like one of the only last copies of this amazing player. And there's so few recordings of him. This was like a full CD or something like that. Or on tape. They knew that once they played it, it was going to be the last time that it worked. And then like literally the next day, like a fire broke out and all those things were destroyed too. So it's just like, some things are just not meant to be heard. And apparently when they were playing it, the guy who owned it was just like talking the entire time, like, listen to him play, listen to this, it's amazing. He's like, dude, I want to hear it myself.
Wow, that is amazing. That is amazing. Some sort of energy in the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And God, must have been amazing, amazing track too.
Definitely. So in talking about things that inspire you and what you find beautiful in life, can you, in your own words, tell me what does living a creative life mean to you?
Oh, being willing to take risk, and then, you know, living with the mistakes and everything like that. Like, I think I'm reminded of a story that a good friend of mine told about the Buddhist wrestler who had It's a very famous parable, I believe. And this Buddhist wrestler had a diamond in his head, like right here, and it was all like right in the middle of his forehead. And he was a famous wrestler; no one could ever beat him. And just for years and years, just one and one and one and undefeated. Then one day, a guy came in, just completely destroyed him, and he got thrown into the mud, and the mud got over the diamond, and he just felt like, oh, I'm the worst person in the world. I'm worthless. There's nothing I can do right. I feel like a huge failure. That one mistake is the end of me. And he went home and just, you know, sat in his own like pity and whatever. Then the Buddha came and wiped off the dirt from the wrestler's head to reveal the diamond was still there. And, you know, that's the parable of the story is that, you know, no matter what happens, you know, nothing in this life will take away your essence, like your spiritual power. And that's I think one that a lot of artists have to, you know, we have to deal with. A lot of us make mistakes. A lot of us do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing or write the wrong piece, or we have a failure. We don't give a good concert. You know, something happens. Collaborating musicians get into a fight and then they break up and then they're never working again together. So many things can happen, but the part of it is how are you going to prevail from it? Are you going to let that end your career and make you stop? Or are you going to learn from that and you're going to just do the best you can to make art and to keep continuing to inspire people? Because even though like that one thing can happen, I think every artist needs to realize that they are inspiring somebody. And even if it's just that one person, that's great. And I think there's even for people who are just starting out and their only fan is their mom. Like, you're inspiring your mom and your mom is so happy and proud of you. Keep going, because before you know it, one person's going to come up, and that one person who becomes your fan is going to tell two people. And now you have three fans, and then it builds and builds and builds. And before you know it, you have a really successful career. Fans will come and go. Things are going to go up and down. Life sucks, but life is what you put into it. If you're going to make it miserable and you're going to make it awful, it's going to be awful. But living a creative life is willing to take the risk to expose yourself to a lot more of that, you know, negative energy, because that's what, you know, taking risk is.
Right, right. And a lot of musicians really struggle with the ups and downs of confidence, whether it's stage fright or just, you know, being bummed about maybe not having a good performance one night, or even the competition among musicians and how it is so difficult to make it as a professional.
Yeah, and I'm one of them. It's a huge struggle. I mean, it's not easy. You know, we want to hold on to our, in the Buddhist teaching is to not hold on to things, like, you know, don't have attachment. And well, what does that mean? Like, don't be attached to this idea of fame. Don't be attached to this idea of like, you know, relationships and things like that, because they're going to go, everything ends and everything, whatever. And it's a really hard lesson. It's easier said than done, because every single time, you know, like if I feel like one of my musician colleagues are mad at me, I just go like, oh my God, I really feel it. And I feel it awful and terrible. And it really bothers me. And like the first thing I'm gonna do is like, oh, how can I fix this and mend it? And it's like, well, first off, just stop doing everything. Just focus on you. You can't fix other people. You can't fix the problems in the world if you yourself aren't like there. And a lot of times, like, I'm a nervous wreck. Like, you know, like every single day, like trying to like, I want to play this piece better. I want to get better at calligraphy. I want to understand more. And it's like, I also forget, like, dude, you're 27. You've got time to do these things. You don't have to freak out every single time you don't know something or you feel like you're not understanding. And I have like these ups and downs of like, just when I think I really understand an aesthetic idea of Japanese culture, something like a monkey wrench gets thrown in, and I go like, oh my God, I know nothing. And then it goes up and like, oh, well, now I understand it. And then it goes down like, oh, I know nothing. And it's just like, there's so many different perspectives on one thing too, that even one idea, it just means different things for so many people.
Would you say that you're motivated by learning more about the culture, or does it seem almost like a challenge to have to overcome?
That's a really good question. And I would probably say that it's a little bit of both, because I want to know that stuff so badly, but I also have met shakuhachi players that have been doing it for like 30 years and they don't know any of that stuff. like, so is it really necessary? Probably not. But like part of like my craziness, like the inner creative artist, just like, I just have to know whether it's like, I don't know. That one's, it's such a difficult question. I mean, that could be like 10 hours of talk. I could write a book about that. Is because, okay, even taking for Shodo, for example, I want to know how people do, like how they start their kihitsu. Kihitsu is the beginning start of a stroke. There are so many different ways of thought about them. Everybody will tell you that this, what one way is right and the other way is wrong. So who's actually right? Whatever works for you. Okay, so now let's bring it back to shakuhachi. Okay, so the piece that's on my stand right now is called Ryobo. All right, so I can look up 10 different performances of this. Every single one's going to be different. Every single one of those people is a grandmaster. Which one's right? Well, so the real answer is it depends. It depends on like how you want to look at it. And what I would say is whichever one works for you. And what I'm actually finding out now is none of them work for me. And I just want to come up with my own. Like, I don't care like how, you know, they play it in this sect or in that sect, or if this person's out of the sectarian way of playing and they just do it their own. Well, that's, it works great for them, but it's not what works great for me. And I think that's what my Shodo teacher also embodies is, you know, she now, like in her 80s, she's like, I don't even paint characters anymore. I don't even do like calligraphy as an art like that. I do things beyond that. I don't need a character to express it. I have to go beyond that. And I understand that. And so for me, maybe I look at the oboe and I go, you know what? I don't even need half of this piece. I only need the first two lines and the last two lines to express what I actually want to express. So then I've created my own version of the oboe that's not, you know, whatever. Or maybe I use half the piece or 75% of the piece. And I just say, I don't need to repeat these, like some of these things. I'm just going to take out this entire section of music because it's meaningless to me. And I'm going to replace it with an improvisation instead. Or maybe I'll just do an improvisation based off the oboe and I'll be even more happy because I can actually express what I want to express. So I think that part is the hardest because especially in like in Japanese culture, it's such a way of doing things that's so important. Like keeping the tradition of how things were done previously is really important. But that's not me, though. That's not my spirit. And there's a lot of other shakuhachi, very famous players who were like that too. And they played outside of the schools and they just did things the way that they wanted to do because it didn't fulfill what they wanted to say. And so I find myself in that sort of category where it's like, I don't really care if it's not what's traditional, if that sounds not traditional. What I'm taking a traditional piece and I'm updating it to making it fit my needs, which is I have something I want to say. People might ask, well, what are you trying to say? I don't know. I'll let you know once I've said it.
And I feel like that's really a core of art. It's taking the tools, taking the resources, and then creating something that's pure and true to you, the person as an artist, and what you want to say.
Yeah.
Just like when someone writes a book, they take all the words of their language they want to write in, and they write something new. It's not like they're copying off of anyone else. They're just writing something new using the same tools. You know, you're taking shakuhachi and you're taking maybe these pieces and maybe you're doing variations and improvisations and you're still being true to it, but you're also being true to yourself by creating something new. But I can completely understand, you know, like it's a journey and it really is. You know, I can't sum it up much more than that, you know. Yeah.
Well, also, you know, what I'm also thinking about now is that, like, I could listen back to this podcast that we're creating, like, 15 years from now and be like, wow, I absolutely knew nothing. I was a complete idiot then. Who thinks like that? Or I could look back and be like, wow, I wish I could return to that, be more like that, or, you know, anything. But it's like, I always wondered about, like, I've seen so many musicians who are just so certain about, and I'm talking like older musicians and younger musicians, they're so certain about how they do things and the way that they do things. And like I've heard recordings where they play the same way for 30 years. And I go like, how do they know? Like, that's the way they want to express it. Like, how did they find that? Or maybe that is bad or something like that. Maybe it's not the right way. But like for me, like I'm just like constantly like, what am I doing? I don't even know what I'm trying to say. And then sometimes like I'll get a really good performance of something and I go, how did I do that? Like, I don't even know what happened. Like, it's like outer body of experience. I played it and then the piece was over and I was like, huh, I guess that was okay. I listened back and I go, whoa, that was interesting. How did I do that? I don't remember doing anything. And I think it's the same thing with like composition too. Like, I don't remember how I wrote a really good piece, and then it stresses me out because I'm like, oh, I want to write that piece again, and that never works. And anytime I ever want to recreate a performance, oh my God, it's like the worst thing ever.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, oh my God, I have a tragic story. Tragic. It was I had one of my students here for, he was doing shugyo with me. He came here and did a bread and breakfast and was studying shakuhachi. And, you know, we're playing shakuhachi 5 hours, you know, a day. And then we go walk around and come back and play some more. And at dinner on the last night, I felt inspired to just play him a piece. And so I played him a piece called Daha, which means the beating waves. And I have told this story now to, like, I think like 10 different people because I'm still very upset about it. And I played this piece Daha, and it was by far the most amazing performance of Daha I've ever done. And I felt afterwards, I was like, I'm the shit. That was so good. Then I was like, I cannot wait to record this piece tomorrow. It's going to be the best thing I've ever done. Not even close. Not even half of what it was. And then I asked my student, I was like, okay, listen to my performance of Daha on YouTube. And do you remember the one on that I gave you at the dinner one night? He goes, the one at dinner was so much better. Doesn't even compare to this. And it's just like that moment in history. It's just the memory. It's just the memory of that, like one amazing moment. But it was that, what I think that I did there was I just let it all go. I just took the energy that was at that moment. You know, we had a long day of shakuhachi playing. We were in really high spirits. We had really good sushi. You know, a couple nice bottles of sake, and everything was just set perfectly. There's no cameras, there's no mics, there's just myself, my wife, and my student play the piece, incredible performance, and that's it. The moment's done, the moment's over. And that being recreated will never happen. And trying to recreate that is just a waste of time.
I know you say it's a tragedy, but I think you could categorize it as a triumph, because by not being able to recreate it again, it makes it all the more special.
Yes, I think the reason why it's a tragedy for me is it's not recorded and I want to listen to it again. And yeah, so there's that sort of thing. But also, I get that too, where now it's just a memory. And it's kind of special because only three people get to share it. Myself, my wife, and my student.
Mm-hmm. Very exclusive.
It's a very exclusive club.
But what's interesting that you brought up about how you want to listen to a recording of it is, would you want to possibly spoil such a special memory?
Me? Yes. other people know, but it's part of the craziness, because it's like I want to like analyze it and just figure out like, what did I do that time? And I do that. I think that's probably one of my downfalls as a shakuhachi player, is in one of my blind spots, is that I worry too much about the times that I made a good note. And I don't, like, I need to take that lesson from my teacher where he says, that moment when I make a bad note, that's part of the piece, that's me. I'd be like, God, I just need to do that. Like, when the note just goes flub, just be like, yes, that was great.
I sense that you're a perfectionist.
Just a little bit? Is that
comfort? Just a tad.
Just a tad. Okay.
just a smidge.
I'll tell you where I'm not a perfectionist, though, is when I write in English and, like, when I write things out. I think any editor that looks at my English writing would just be like, please go back to school. Please go back to school and write. And remember all those red marks? Those aren't good. Those bad.
Well, did you write the bio on your own website? Because I thought it was very good.
No, I did not.
Oh, okay.
I hired somebody.
Well, whoever you hired, it was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. She's awesome. So when I asked her to write that for me, and she's a technical writer for doctors. So even like doctors, they don't write their own things all the time. They hire somebody else to do that stuff for them. So it's, you know, my job is to play music and to write music. Her job is to write words. And so I don't have to wear every single hat, you know, to do those things. I already have to do my own video editing, audio editing, YouTube management, social media production. Then I have to manage my own finances, be my own accountant, find out, like, I have enough jobs already. And then on top of that, so I don't mind, you know, paying somebody some money, take the tax deduction and say, please make me look better and not like a dum-dum. So her process was, okay, you're going to write a bio for me and you're going to tell me everything you want. And I want you to write about yourself as egotistically as possible. So I know everything you can do. And then I'm going to make you look better with doing this. I'm going to turn it around and I will write it and it will be great. And then she did. And I'm like, wow, that is really good. Oh, she's a very good writer. I've actually done that a lot before and I remember actually I did that for one of my concert programs where I wanted somebody to write all of the the notes about my piece, where like, okay, I told them about it. Like I would talk to the writer and say, this is what the piece is about. And then they would say, oh, okay. They took notes and then they'd write it and they'd say, okay, how is this? And I go, okay, that's right, but I don't like this word, and we'd work on it and change it. But like writing is an art in itself. And you know, that's a whole nother thing that I'm not so good. I'm a much better speaker than I am a writer.
You are an eloquent speaker and a very interesting storyteller as well.
I like stories. Me too. And that's another thing, part of that, what inspires my shakuhachi playing, is sometimes I do have a narrative structure in pieces where I have like characters in mind, and they have names and they go to places. Where are they going? What's the grass like there? How is the sun? Is it hot or is it even there? Is it a cloudy day? How's the wind? What's the temperature outside? And that affects all of the things for shakuhachi, because I can make a cold note with a shimmery, glassy sound of the sun on the water, or I can make a warm note that's like, that's overly humid, and it's just kind of like dragging your feet to try to get to the next place without, like, you know, pouring sweat. And I want that experience to be in the note.
As a person who's listened to some of your recordings, I feel like I can feel that. I feel like I can imagine that myself. Like, you do a very, very good job.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Do you have a favorite piece of all time to play on shakuhachi, or is it just sort of depend on your mood?
You know, I used to hate this answer, because every time somebody gave me an answer, I'd be like, such a cop-out, man. It's the piece I'm working on at any given moment. I hate that answer. It makes me sick that I even said that.
But if it's true.
Like, I feel less of a musician. Like, that was such an easy answer. It's like, dude, come on, man. You can be better than that. But the answer's no. I just like what I'm working on. It's what I'm focusing on. I don't think about like everything else. I will say that the piece that I really work on a lot is called Honshirabe. And it's one of the first pieces that you learn in like for traditional Japanese music tradition. And in my school, like in my studio, in my teacher's studio, it was one of the first pieces that in his book about traditional music. And when I first started shakuhachi, it was the first piece that I learned too. And it's interesting because reading, like, I like reading CD liner notes too, about, it's a great place to get information about history of different mm-hmm. pieces. And also I found out a really bad place to get information about pieces too, because there's a lot of stuff that's right and there's a lot of stuff that's really wrong. And I wish I would have known that before. But the piece that this one, it's said to be about 400 years old, and it comes from the Hamamatsu region of Japan, which is in Shizuoka, which is just down the street from me, actually, just like three or four hours by train. The thing is that they said that the wandering monks, the Komuso of Japan, would play this piece every single day. Like, that was a daily practice piece.
Kind of like Bach.
Kind of like Bach, right? I go around to different temples and locations and shrines, and I do shugyo, which is aesthetic training. You know, you wear kimono, you wear your proper shoes and tabi, and you know, the full thing. You bring your shakuhachi with you, and as you're going to different places, you play shakuhachi. And now there's pieces that are designed for certain things and whatever, but there's no like set rule of how to do shugyo, or anyways, it's you create your own. And not like we have writings of how Komuso, these monks, did the shugyo anyways, or at least I haven't seen it. And so I use that piece. I use that piece, and like, I'll go to a place and I'll just play Honshirabe. And then I'll walk 15 minutes, hike up a small mountain, and then get to the next shrine and I'll play Honshirabe. And then I'll go to another place and then play Honshirabe. And then by the end, like, I've played, you know, 50 Honshirabes that day for 5 hours, and I played it differently every single time. And then sometimes I'm like, wow, I added something because I was just so exhausted and I couldn't think. Or like at that time, I completely skipped a line. And this is interesting of like how the piece transforms, or how I do different things that, you know, weren't there before. And it gives me ideas for, you know, for music. Or one thing I noticed is that when you walk and you play flute, you get this bounce. And so like in my friend who I do the shugyo with, he was saying like, yeah, I think it'd be really interesting if you added that bounce in your piece. Like, if you played a piece that was about takahatsu, about begging, and you're walking, you have the bounce. You should add that bounce in the piece. And I was like, oh my God, that's a really good idea. So in these pieces that don't have bounce written in them, but they're pieces that are begging pieces, I added it. And I was like, wow, that really changes it a lot. And I kind of like it. And then it kind of like became to love, to now where I do it too much. So, but it's just like that kind of experiment of doing it. I would say that Hon Shirabe would probably be that piece of like my favorite, because I've discovered so much in it and it continues to teach me.
And music seems to have that effect on us as musicians. You know, it could be the simplest piece in the world and you will always learn something.
Mm, yes.
I can't remember which musician said it, but I think I'll have to look it up because I'm terribly curious. But there's this string player, I think, that said he plays something different every time, you know, and why wouldn't he? I don't know. I'll have to look it up because it reminded me of what you were saying, you know, your interpretation's different, you know, maybe because it's the end of the day versus the beginning of the day when you were like hopped up on coffee or something. And you know, maybe you took the tempo a little quicker at the beginning of the day and then the tempo slowed as the day wore on, you know, or maybe your hand got tired and sounded different, but it's all part of the message, part of the energy of that piece in that moment and you in that moment, very honest revelation.
Or your hands get really, really cold. Cause we went out doing shugyo in -4°C. And so it's like, you know, 20 degrees or something like that. It was really cold. And we hiked up a mountain. And when we got to the top of the mountain, like your body's not cold because you're moving. And like, you know, hiking for 4 hours straight, you know, the blood gets moving and you stay warm. But when you get to the top of the mountain and then you realize that there's a cold, icy wind that hits your face, that changes the piece where it's like, all right, I'm gonna play this really fast so I can get out of here. It's cold.
Yes. Does that affect your flute? The sound of the flute itself, the weather?
Yeah, it flattens it. It flattens it a lot. Like, you know, anytime it's really cold and it's really hard to control the air because of the wind outside. So it's actually easier to play in the woods where there's not, you know, a breeze. But yeah, it just, it always depends. Also, like you try to, like, it's not something you try to do nor like do, but I think inherently, like when you hear like those other sounds of like nature, like you hear the waterfall in the distance, it makes you change the way you play. And then, you know, you collaborate with the birds and you hear those sounds and you start to, you know, tighten up the sound to make more whistles at the end and whatever. So yeah, there's a lot of that sort of stuff. Just being in nature changes the way you interpret the music.
Other than being in the really freezing weather, that sounds extremely peaceful and it makes me want to go pick up shakuhachi now just to experience like interacting with the birds.
Part of it really sucks though, because like shakuhachi takes an enormous amount of air, and so hiking up a mountain while playing at the same time is like, hiking is already difficult, playing is already difficult, putting them both together just sucks. But once you like come home and like the next day you wake up, you're like, all right, I feel like playing some shakuhachi, and then you play, you go like, wow, this is so easy. So it's not even just necessarily aesthetic training, but it's also like, you know, just really great lung training. And you don't have to be in Japan to do it. Like, you can go anywhere. I mean, just like when, even in Texas, I mean, there's plenty of parks that are like huge, like national parks where you can go and just walk around and play shakuhachi, and you know, and you can get amazing, like it's an amazing experience. Just, or go to like a local mountain, local hillside or something, but that stuff's free. You don't have to pay anybody to do that. You know, the only thing I have to pay for is a train ticket, which both ways cost me like $8. And so $8 to have like, you know, a 5 to 6 hour experience in nature that I can just play my flute as loud as I want, as soft as I want, as waterfall like as I want. I mean, I'd take that any day.
That sounds so peaceful and almost transcending to an extent.
I'll let you know when I transcend.
You're getting there. Yeah, maybe next week, right?
Maybe in 10 minutes. I don't know.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more with shakuhachi player Sean Head. If you enjoy my podcast, Creative Piecemeal, then check out Musician's Dish. Freelance musicians Robin Anderson and Audra Sergel are longtime pals, work wives, music teachers, recording artists, church musicians, directors, advocates, and now podcasters. Their bi-monthly conversations casually examine the ins and outs of being modern music entrepreneurs with multiple earning streams. Sometimes these conversations devolve into the gutter. Other times, they're truly uplifting. Every episode is a dish. Listen in for epic gig stories, ways they did and didn't survive 2020, not a great year for musicians or most people, as it turns out, how they handle performance anxiety and maneuver the healthcare system, how they get paid, and the worst jobs they've taken for $100 or less, including some adjunct work. Every episode of Musician's Dish is a deep dive for your ear holes, curse words guaranteed. New episodes every other Monday. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor FM, or wherever you like to tune in. And we are back with shakuhachi player and composer, Sean Head. Welcome back to the show. So we're going to keep going with some more questions. And I've been curious to know, since you are in Japan, how has the current situation affected your creative process and your music making?
I would say that in terms of, like, you know, actually creating stuff, not so much. But the inspiration that I get for playing in front of people, that, of course, is just completely gone. There's not a lot of... I had my first concert scheduled for March 20th. And if all goes well, that will stay on. But, you know, all of Japan is back into a state of emergency, which means that a lot of places are just closed down. And it's really sad to see. We were actually at Hozanji yesterday. And it's on a mountainside where we were doing shugyo. And I was looking at all the coffee shops and all the, like, you know, hotels and things, and everything's closed. And I was just like, God, that's so multi-nai. Like, you know, how awful that is. Things are just sitting there and not being utilized and stuff like that. And it's the same thing with all the, like, musicians, though. Like, all these musicians have this amazing gift that they could be sharing with everybody and like, you know, there's so many great artists in the world, and they could be, you know, out in public and in person playing for people and inspiring, and that's just not there. So I feel very down about that. And I try to do things like, you know, that's why I've uploaded so much to YouTube this past year, is just, you know, doing like a performance every single day, having a video, because the people just don't have that anymore. And, you know, it's not like YouTube makes a lot of money. Like, I think if people knew how much I made this year on YouTube, they'd be like, oh, like, so you're basically doing it for free. And so my YouTube summary this year is, like, from November to now is a whopping $20 in advertisement money. So, and that's, like, that's thousands upon thousands of views, and just really nothing. You know, it's not about that. It's just about, you know, giving people, you know, inspiration to hopefully do their own art. And what I've noticed is I've actually noticed other people starting to upload more of their own performances, which is just so great. Like, YouTube and all the, like, Venmo and all the other, or Vimeo, are all these outlets for, you know, getting videos as a way that we can at least express our art somehow. So trying to find ways, but, you know, when you're looking at a screen and you play a piece and you finish and there's no clap, you just see a bunch of text pop up, and or maybe a couple heart reacts or something like that. It's just not the same as, you know, looking into the person's eye and seeing that, like, oh, I really enjoyed that, or next piece, please.
Yeah, there's definitely an energy and a give and take from playing live, or even conversely hearing a piece live or a band or an artist live, that is lost in translation, so to speak, via recording. But at least we have these capabilities, you know, people are still able to share their music, and people are still being able to be inspired by it. It just looks different. It feels different. You know, it's a whole nother medium.
Absolutely. I do wish that, like, you know, we could do, I did go to a concert 3 days ago, and was it 3 days ago or 2 days ago? Well, it doesn't matter. And you know, there was very, very, very few people there. You know, I would probably say there was probably 20 in the audience. Like, the hall could actually fit like 250 to 300 people. So, you know, 10th of capacity. And it's just, the energy is different. You know, people just don't feel like, people don't want to clap loud. They don't want to, like, say anything. Everybody's really quiet. And it's not like, that's not just like a Japanese thing. It's just like, people just don't want to, like, the corona, 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 corona. It's all they're thinking about the entire time. And then when somebody coughs in the audience, you can feel the tension in the air. Just everybody goes, what is that? And it really ruins it. Like, it just, people can't just, they can't just let go and just listen to the music.
That's so sad that, you know, it's affecting the ability to enjoy art in that way, you know, even live art when you're protected, like you said.
Yeah.
But in a positive spin, what is something that you're most thankful for during this unusually historic time?
Well, I did meet my wife at this time, so that was great. And also, it really inspired me to move to Japan, because I thought, you know, I knew that I can't say I knew, I'm not like a fortune teller, but when I saw that there was like the virus popping up in China and how fast it was spreading, I knew that it was just a matter of time before it went to Japan, before it went to Korea, then before it comes to the States. And I knew that it was going to be a lot bigger than, you know, in the onset of it. I knew that for a fact. I just had that feeling in my gut. And so I said to myself, you know, maybe this might be the time to just pick up and move to Japan. And my now wife and I, when we were talking about that, we were thinking, what do you want to do? Because if we don't act fast, you know, one, we're probably not going to be able to see each other again, because the traveling between countries is just impossible. Or we can try to stay in America, but getting a visa for America, you have to go back to Japan, and they're not going to let you fly back here. Or, you know, so what is it going to be? And so it's a lot easier to get the visa for Japan. So he said, all right, well, let's just do Japan. It makes sense for me to be there anyways. It's always somewhere I wanted to live. And, you know, we can easily create a life there because your family is there. We have a support unit where in America, like I have family, but it's not like, I mean, you know, you probably have family in other states, you know, like we don't see each other that often, because going from one state to another is actually a big deal in America, whereas going from one prefecture to Japan to another is just like, yeah, that's a 2-hour like train ride and $11, you know, one way, where, you know, you want to do that in America, you're talking like lots of money, hundreds of dollars just to do that. So we ended up deciding to do the Japan thing. So I would say that's the two highlights is, one, I'm living in this beautiful house in Japan. I have a lovely wife, and I'm able to live my life to the fullest and express it as much as I can. And I think just living in the old style, living in a house that has only tatami mats, and, you know, where we feel the seasons, we cook in the old style, you know, it's having a garden out front that you have to take care of, doing the traditions here and being able to focus on myself and not traveling constantly, has also been really great. Before the Corona thing happened, I was traveling, usually 2 times a month to somewhere to do a concert or to do some sort of collaboration. In February and March alone of last year, I think I did seven different concerts in 7 different states. And January, I was out in California doing collaborations and, you know, doing video making, and I was in other places. So yeah, it was a really hectic lifestyle to be traveling like that. And eating out all the time is really not good for your body, I found.
It sounds like you really came away with a lot of really positive things, you know, and congratulations on moving and all those wonderful new life experiences that you get to have now. And
it's great to not live out of a suitcase. Let me tell you, that's there. When I was doing my first like sort of mini tour, I would say, I went to Japan and then I came back and I did some concerts in America, and it was about 3 months long. And I was so sick of living out of a suitcase, because I would go back to my house, but I'd only be there for 2 days and then I'd leave again. And like, it's not like I'm complaining like, oh my gosh, I have work and I'm playing music for a living. How awful is that? No, it's just like everything has its downside. And that was the one thing that really sucked, was just always out of a suitcase. And, you know, like, I just want to hang my clothes up and just being able to walk into the closet and grab it, not have to dig through a suitcase and repack it constantly. And sleeping in your own bed is actually became like something that was awesome. I remember when it was time for like, hey, let's go on vacation. Be like, yeah, where are we going to go in Houston? I want to stay in Houston and do something here for vacation. I don't want to travel anywhere.
And I can only imagine that it's very, very taxing on musicians, traveling musicians. And I don't know how those people do it. I guess you just really have to, love the art, and there's so many sacrifices.
I think of somebody like Yo-Yo Ma, who was traveling like every other day, it seems, to do a concert somewhere, and, you know, not even getting to stay in the air. Like, I was lucky enough where I was staying in the location for at least like 3 or 4 days, and sometimes up to a week, where I could at least relax and enjoy some of the things there and, you know, to go out to eat and meet people that were at the university that I was, you know, doing the concert at, or, you know, I get to make friends with somebody and we get to hang out and have free time. But someone like that, you know, they're just constantly on the move from one interview to the next interview to the concert. And so I'm glad, like, I didn't do that sort of thing. But I would say I've spent a lot of time waiting in airports.
That must be so draining.
There's only, like, I'm not a big reader. Like, I don't like to necessarily read, which probably reflects why I am not a good writer. And I mean, I've read a lot of books and like journal articles and, you know, papers about, like, you know, the things that I'm doing and studying. And there's only just so much you can do where you just go, like, can I just watch Netflix?
Yeah. Sometimes it's just important to give your brain a break like that, you know, especially when you're on the road so much. But that's great to hear that you're stabilized, you know, and you don't have to travel as much unless it's something that you really needed to do. Do you think in the future, would you continue to do touring? Like, once it's safe to travel, would you consider that?
Yeah, I definitely want to, but I'm going to try to stick more on the, like, on the Asian side of things. I'd like to go to Taiwan, China, Korea, and, you know, maybe Pacific Islands and do more concerts there. And of course, doing more stuff in Japan. I really want the experience for, like, playing. I've played a lot for Japanese audiences, but I'd like to do a lot more of it, because it's a different type of environment to play for Japanese, but any culture, it's different. You know, they come with their own, you know, I wouldn't call it, like, we'll call it cultural baggage for the sake of the conversation, but it's not like a negative thing. It's just that it's different, and that different experience really helps put into, like, light how I interpret things and how I, you know, present myself and whatever. I've noticed that from a few concerts that I have gone to in Japan, where I'd probably say I've been to, like, maybe 20 or 30 concerts. And I noticed that a lot of the artists don't talk. It's usually somebody else who speaks. They have, like, an announcer who says, like, all right, everybody, please set off your phones to the silent mode. Hai, minasama konnichiwa. Ashi o hakobi ni arigatou gozaimasu. And then it's like always the same type of voice, same type of speech, and then they'll introduce the pieces and they just say the name, but they don't really go into detail about it. But it's written in the pamphlet so people can read. But I wonder, like, what if I try to communicate and engage with my audience member more, and, you know, do the things that I was doing in America, like telling stories. Like, I don't talk so much, like, history and things like that on, like, in concerts. That's not my forte. What I do is I create a story, and then I take people along that journey with me so they can experience the music how I experience it. So I'm wondering, what if I do that with people in Japan? How will that go over? Will people enjoy it? Will people be like, eh, take it or leave, it doesn't matter. Some people like it, some people don't, you know, it, whatever. But it's just something I want to try.
And you never know until you try. I think it would be interesting, you know, especially since you said you came, you know, you grew up in America, you come from a Western perspective, you know, you go to a conservatory and it's a lot of the music is the Western perspective, you know, history of Western music, you know, is a very popular music history book. And so coming in to another country, learning the culture, playing an instrument of that other culture, you know, other than the one in which you're a native, you know, it sounds like you're doing things to learn and grow and be respectful, but also put your own spin on it.
You know, I feel like what I'm doing is almost what happened in the 1950s and 60s with classical music, where a lot of Asian players started to come over from, you know, China, Japan, Korea, and do music in America. And it went over, like, they played really, really well. But they felt like a lot of restriction, like, well, this is not my culture and blah, blah, blah. It's like, it's not really America's culture either. It's European culture. And so I understand how they feel, like how they felt at that time. And so, and I can kind of see, like, oh, this, it's not my culture or whatever, but it's like, yeah, but, you know, music is music. It's, you know, those Chinese musicians in the 1950s weren't playing Beethoven because they were just like, oh, I know, I must become more Westernized. And it's like, they heard that and they found something amazing to it. And they found something that moved them and inspired them to the point where they wanted to try to go to America and play, or they wanted to go to Europe and perform and, you know, show them their interpretation of it. And so, yeah, I think it's just a continuation of like how the arts can actually really connect us and shows everybody like in the world how human we are and how more similar we are than different.
I completely agree. You know, and like you said, music is music, and this could be applied to any of the creative arts, really. You know, it's about making something and sharing it and experiencing it and bringing people together. And, you know, you were talking about how people from the Chinese musicians coming over playing Beethoven. For me, I remember taking this world music class in college, and I really connected with klezmer music. And I grew up, I'm a half Japanese, half European descent, raised in a Catholic household, but I absolutely loved klezmer music, which is from the Jewish culture. And for some reason, I connected with that kind of music. And I also connected with Celtic music. You know, I don't think I have a lick of Irish in me at all. You know, and it's just about what you connect with, what speaks to you. And it doesn't necessarily matter if it's from your native culture or even ethnicity. It's really about the art and it, that it touches you.
Yeah. And that's what shakuhachi has always been for me. I just, there's no word, there's no action, there's no nothing that can describe like why. It's just the other thing too is just like, why is this the instrument that I'm good at? You know, it's like, why was this the passion? Why was this the thing? Like I could have just kept doing viola and violin. I could just try to find a way to make my, you know, heal the injury and, you know, do like training and exercises. But why was I so readily willing to just say, you know, viola is viola and whatever, that part of my life's over, let's go to composition. You know, it's all like, it's like there's more meaning behind it. And yeah, I love it. I just love it so much. And I think you feel the same way about like the things that you're doing. Like you just find this passion and driving force. And, you know, I remember when people said, they're just like, you want to do a what? It's like, I want to become a shakuhachi player. And I think I want to do this as a career. And they go, good luck. Thank you. And I'll tell you, I mean, the beginning was awful. I mean, when I first started in the professional world, I worked four jobs. I worked as a high school orchestra director. I was a violin private teacher. I was doing concerts and with orchestras, playing as a violinist and a violist. And then on the side, I was doing shakuhachi. And I barely had any concerts. I didn't have, like, I was just like an absolute nobody. And there's like, what's a shakuhachi? Like, and why do I care? And I had to make that case for them. And so some people knew it, and some people have like heard of other players in the States and whatever. Like, and it's floated around, but it was a really hard sell. And it took a lot of work. And it was, I think, you know, working with composers was probably like my saving grace, is just playing really hard music and just whatever they wrote, just, I said, just write whatever you want, I'll play it. And just building relationship with those people and, you know, just being sincere, just loving the instrument and just playing as much as I could. Then before I knew it, I didn't have to teach the high school job anymore. I could just do private lessons, and I had more concerts coming in, and I could write music again. And then I was really reluctant about taking shakuhachi students. That was something I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. I was so scared because I was just like, oh my God, I don't feel like I know anything. Like, what am I going to teach them? And then I just finally broke down. My first student, I went up to Minnesota and I gave a concert, and he was like, just, I would love to take lessons with you. Please, I would love to take lessons. I'm very serious. I've always wanted to do this. I've been practicing and playing. I've been on and off with shakuhachi for 10 years with different students. And I just, the way you talk about shakuhachi, I jive with that. I want to learn that. And I go, I don't even know what I'm doing, but okay. And then I'm so glad that I did that, because the teaching the shakuhachi, and that has made all the difference. It's made me such a better player, and it's made me such a better person. And I love my studio. I love my studio, and I love all of my students so much. We meet every single week, like the entire studio body. We all get on Skype and we do a master class. We listen to music together. We talk shakuhachi. We just do our insights. You know, it's just, it's really like a family. And that's it. So I've really been able to just carve out this entire thing where I don't just play shakuhachi. I don't just, you know, work with, you know, a maker and, you know, sell instruments. I don't just teach. I don't just do master. I do as much as I can with it. I want to get every single part of it, from the training in the mountains to waking up on Thursday morning to teach a student.
And even though you came to Shakuhachi later in your musical life, you know, you've found your passion.
Well, you know, some people, they don't like, I feel like I'm falling behind, or I feel like I'm late on something. I remember that there used to be this thing on Facebook where they said, like, time is relative. And then they would give all these famous people, like Whoopi Goldberg didn't make her first big appearance until like in her 40s or something like that. Or this actor didn't have a big break, or this musician didn't sell their first CD since they were 50. And then I realized at that point, it's like, well, you know what? When, if I feel like the something is not moving forward, that just means it's not my time yet and I have to wait. It will be there. And if I don't want to rush it, don't want to push it, it's just let it happen naturally and organically. And so just doing the things I want, not feeling the pressure to have to do anything. And that's, I guess, another thing that Corona has really helped with, is that I have to be a lot more patient, because that's, I'm very patient with my students. I'm very patient with many things in life, but what I'm not patient with is myself. I'm demanding of, like, why aren't you good at this yet? Like, get better. Why aren't you playing at this level? Why can't you do this piece? Why can't you understand these two concepts? Why aren't you able to do this? And it's just that constant, like, beating down, and just like, bro, lift up, man. Go outside and go look at the flowers for a second, and then come back and play it. Just let it be. And that's me talking now and telling myself that. But again, easier said than done. Because when I'm in the heat of battle working with the Shakuhachi, sometimes I don't feel like we're working together. Sometimes I feel like we're at each other's throats trying to, you know, do different things. And that's just, you know, experience, communication error between me and the instrument.
I was talking a few weeks back with Dr. Jennifer Higdon, another composer, Pulitzer Prize winning composer, and she famously was a late bloomer, you know, not starting her musical education until she was 18. And then, of course, she just blossomed. But I think, just like with you finding the Shakuhachi later in life, it comes down to persistence. It comes down to a passion. Like, it is what you're meant to do. And sure, you may like beat yourself up about certain things sometimes, and you may have a bad, well, quote unquote, bad practice session, but it's about, you know, it's just, the important thing is you found your passion, and no, time's going to pass anyway, you know, and just do what you got to do, you know?
I think the biggest thing is, it's like, and this is like my big thing about being a teacher, is that, like, is what I'm teaching, like, right? And like, what is right? Because I wonder that too. Like, when I was like teaching Mozart, I'm like, I don't know if this is right. Like, what does it even mean? Like, I hear these recordings, and, you know, another person will say, oh, that's how we used to play it in the 70s. I'm like, what does that mean? It means how we played. Like, has everything, do you hold the bow differently than before? Or like, you shape the phrases differently? Like, and so I'm thinking, like, I look at this music, like, when I teach a student, like, oh, I do it this way. Why do I do it this way? Is that right? What is right? I mean, and at some point, like, what I'm noticing more and more, like, as daily comes, as the days pass, and as I play Shakuhachi more, the more and more I don't care what right is. Because what I view right as is, did I express myself? What was I thinking about, or what was I not thinking about, or how did I feel at that moment? Did I take the energy that was around me at that moment, and did I express it properly? No? Well, that's wrong. But I played all the notes right. No, it's wrong. And that's me telling myself. It doesn't matter if you played everything perfectly in tune and everything was great. If you didn't control your energy properly and put that into the, and make a sincere performance, it's wrong. Because you weren't being honest to yourself. And so that's like my message for my students, is like, you know, we can sit all day and talk about how this is how they played it back 400 years ago. But what I just noticed is, I just don't care. Like, that's great. And that's a cool practice. It's a great way to experience things. And I think it's cool to know it. And I think it's important. But as for me expressing myself, the guy who lived 400 years ago, who thought it was cool to do that, probably did the same thing that I was doing, which is like, I'm going to play it this way because it's how I feel. And then stuck because he liked it. And other people said, well, I guess that's traditional. But I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there. I can't verify it. But I just want to play and just express myself the best I can. And that's what I hope to do.
And wasn't it Beethoven that said something like, playing the right notes without passion is inexcusable, or something of that nature?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Because it's not music.
Yeah, you could have all the right notes, and if you're just like a robot about it, like, there's no point.
And I have to thank my teacher, Michael Chikuzen Gold. Is just, he's been like that driving force of just energy and inspiration, you know. And he always has the right quote, he always has the right words, and he's a true pedagogue and just a brilliant teacher. And I got so much from him, and I still, you know, meet with him often just to talk, and it's always enlightening. And one of the things that we've recently been talking about, and I think he's mentioned to me like 4 or 5 times now, is that one of his teachers, like one of the greatest shakuhachi players that ever lived, Katsuya Yokoyama, one thing that he used to say, my teacher has now said this to me, I think probably like 15 times, music is what you put into it. That's it. No more, no less. If the performance is boring, it means you're boring. If the performance is exciting, it means you're exciting. And my teacher using that quote with me is perfect. It's exactly the answer I need every single time I'm feeling about something. And I need to like write that on like every wall and post-its and just put it there and there. It's like, music is what you put into it. That's it. I mean, I think we can sit and talk technique and pitch and all that kind of thing all day, but I think it's more about that, what you put into it. In one of his interviews with Yokoyama on, I have it actually somewhere on my computer, where he talks about like the most inspired performance he ever heard, which was just some guy playing a rendition of like a not so interesting piece, but it was played so sincerely. And he's like, that's the best performance of shakuhachi I've ever heard in my life. Just the old guy sitting at us in the back part of the shop that he owns, just tooting away in shakuhachi, but he just loves it so much. That's shakuhachi, as he put everything into it.
That reminds me of back when I used to play cello, that I loved playing scales. And I know as a classical musician, you probably don't hear too many people say, I really love to play scales, but I just loved the sound of the cello and the instrument so much that even scales were just beautiful. And it really is. And like you said, it's about what you put into it. And I think that can be applied to so much, to life even, not just the arts, but to life. You know, life is what you put into it. And I think you get back from the universe what you put into it.
I guess where I want to leave this is one of the books that I read that really inspired me to view music differently was actually the book Zorba the Greek. And in the book Zorba the Greek, he is like the most, you know, the commercial where he's like, he's the most interesting man in the world. That is Zorba the Greek. He's by far the most interesting person and the wisest person ever. It's fascinating to read that book. Mm-hmm. But he plays an instrument called the sartaki, I think it's called. It's been a while since I've read it. But he doesn't have any, like the guy doesn't have any money, but the way he talks, like he's just a wandering like coal miner and something like that. But he's this free spirit guy. And when he talks about playing the music, that's it. Like it's everything in there. It's just the realities of life, human existence, love, freedom, questions that are unanswered, that maybe they don't have an answer. But I think like the thing that what inspires me the most about, oh, it's the santuri. That's what it is. Santuri is the instrument he plays. But I think here's the thing about Zorba, is that he accepts the world as it is, both natural and human world. And the way he talks about like how he learned the instrument, learning to play it, and what it's like to him, it's so cool. It's that passion and like true passion and love for something that you get to experience when reading the book. So for those who have never read that book, I would say, you know, read Zorba the Greek. It is and also the language is Victorian English. So it's very colorful and, you know, it's so moving. And I want to be like, I bet Zorba the Greek's music, when you listen to it, hits you right to the soul. Like, you know, it's a punch to the gut with a warm hug. It's everything that you need in a performance. And that's what I want to be like that when I play music. I want to be like Zorba the Greek.
And I think that's a fantastic sentiment to end on. But before we go, do you have any web resources or book resources to recommend to someone interested in starting to learn the shakuhachi?
Yes. So I have my own channel on YouTube, but there's a lot of channels online, and there's a lot of people's websites that you can go to that are really great resources for learning about the shakuhachi. So my personal channel is Renzo Flutes on YouTube. Gosh, where to start with those sort of resources? I mean, that's one I'd have to like compile a list of people. The first, that's a hard answer. Yeah, there's so many. There's too many, and in the scholarly research world, it's much different. And I'm not a part of that world, but there's a lot of resources online that you could dig into for the rest of your life when it comes to that. But as just starting with shakuhachi and you're wanting to learn how to play, I would say just take to YouTube, type in shakuhachi, and just listen.
Sounds good. And can you tell me again, where can readers connect to you via social media?
So I have my Facebook page, which is Sean Heads Music. And then also on YouTube, they can reach me there through comments and on the community board.
Excellent. Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining on Creative Piecemeal Podcast. This was definitely a very special episode, I think, for me personally, because of, you know, the topics that we discussed and, you know, the cultural aspects of that. And it has been an absolute delight having you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to be here and, you know, work out my ideas and try to figure out what I'm doing. But I love being here and, you know, I keep up the great work with all the interviews. I love everything you're doing as well.
Thank you so much. And listeners, you can, again, check the show notes for links to Sean's websites and videos and YouTubes. And of course, don't forget to click and subscribe to Creative Piecemeal Podcast. Thanks and take care. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Like the show? Have a question? Stop by the Facebook and Instagram pages. Links are in the show notes or search for Creative Piecemeal Podcast on social media and click follow for all the latest.